This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director, and I am grateful for your company. In the next half hour, excerpts from the in-depth series from Virginia Public Radio on the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline, its impact, whether it's really needed, and the potential downside for Dominion. Also, WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini talks with local health professionals about the opioid crisis in Virginia. But first, Dena Reed's four-year term on Harrisonburg's city council began this year. She says she never planned to run for office, but now she's the mayor. In the second installment of WMRA's Women of Interest series, Christopher Clymer Kurtz has this profile.
When Harrisonburg native Dena Reed won her race for city council, which subsequently chose her to be mayor, she had dubbed herself an everyday leader for everyday people.
I mean, I'm not a wealthy person. I live in the same community that I grew up in. You know, I'm not a lawyer I'm a program director for an after-school program, right? And I'm your mayor.
Tuesday, July 11, 2017, city council meeting to order. Roll call, please, Mary Hope.
Mayor Reed.
Here.
But each and every day is product and part of history, as she full well knows.
I was surrounded, and I always talk about women who kind of had their hands on me when I was growing up. And that would be my mom, of course, and my grandmother and my aunt. My grandmother had these friends, Miss Wilhelmina Johnson, Miss Barbara Blakey, who was my high school teacher. And those women kept their hands on me as I was growing up, but they also were community activists, and community service was at their core. All of them are with me in this moment because I'm standing on their shoulders.
After she graduated from Harrisonburg High School, Reed studied for a couple years at Radford University, then spent a couple decades living and working in business in Charlottesville and then Richmond. She returned to Harrisonburg to care for her aging grandmother and substitute taught in the city schools. She has served with a variety of community organizations and is now the program director for an after-school program called On the Road Collaborative. Reed said that when she found herself working with young girls of color, she realized that she was embodying the women who shaped her.
And I think that was a defining moment that I was actually being the mentor to young girls the way Miss Wilhelmina and Miss Blakey were being mentors to me. That I'm like, oh, wow. Now I'm doing this. You know, now I'm them. And then, of course, I decided to run for office, which was totally different.
Had you ever anticipated doing that?
No. Do you want to hear that story?
Reed said she was concerned about overcrowding in Harrisonburg High School and began attending city council meetings.
And I was sitting there one night, and I was listening. And it just dawned on me, I was them women up there, right?
She found out that with only a handful of exceptions, Harrisonburg City Council members have always been white men.
Harrisonburg is a very diverse community, but the leadership wasn't diverse. So I went out and tried to find a woman to run.
That woman turned out to be herself.
I mean, I'm not trying to say anything, but, you know, it's time to have women in these leadership roles, right? Because at 52,000 people in population, you know, women are over 50%. Of that population, right? We are more than men. So our voices are important and needed to be heard. And just having three women over, you know, that's not acceptable. So I kind of wanted to break that glass ceiling.
And again, she points back to the women who shaped her.
I remember they would always make us, and I said make, they would always make us speak at church. Even when we were young, you know, I'm talking about, you know, 10 or 11, 12. I remember this vividly. You know, stand up in front of people, and we either had to quote scripture or read something. And I hated that because I was unsure. I was uncomfortable. And then I remember standing over here at the council chambers and delivering my caucus speech. And it was so clear to me, I was being prepared by them ladies for that moment.
She also points to the girls she mentors. She said some were at that caucus speech.
It was like, now these girls can see themselves in this role.
With that history, her foundation, and a city council term only begun, Reed also has an eye on a personal goal, completing her education degree.
I decided probably about 5 years ago, I said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and finish this. I need to finish this. So I've been working on it, but I got to get through this one class, and the one class is math. Okay.
And you're looking out the window all around the room. Like, is there anything else we can talk about?
But I'm going to do it.
You're going to do it.
I'm going to do it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clemmer-Kurtz.
Any item placed on the consent agenda will be removed and taken up as a separate matter if so requested.
Support for WMRA's Women of Interest series comes from F&M Bank, a local independent community bank since 1908 with locations throughout the Shenandoah Valley. Online at fmbankva.com.
Learn more about Mayor Reed and our Women of Interest series at wmra.org. In July, a committee of scientists and legal experts chaired by UVA law professor Richard Bonney made several recommendations to address the opioid problem. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini talked with him and some Charlottesville area healthcare professionals about the report and about possible solutions.
Last November, Virginia State Health Commissioner Marissa Levine declared the state's opioid addiction crisis to be a public health emergency, and it's getting worse fast. The Virginia Department of Health says the number of overdoses due to opioids in Virginia has skyrocketed to more than 1,400 in 2016. That's a 38% increase over 1 year. This includes prescription drugs such as oxycodone and Vicodin, as well as heroin, which is illegal. And they are now the number one cause of unnatural death, ahead of deaths from guns and road accidents. That's a grave concern for the Food and Drug Administration.
The FDA asked the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine to do a study on pain management and the opioid problem. The main focus for the FDA was to advise them how they could better regulate opioid drugs and make decisions about approval of drugs and monitoring of the use of them that takes public health considerations into account.
That's Richard Bonney, professor of medicine and law and of public policy at UVA. He chaired the committee in charge of the report, which took about a year to complete. One proposal, a change in mentalities.
We think there needs to be a culture change in the education of physicians and other prescribers, and also in public understanding of the role of opioids.
Patients don't always realize what their pain medication really is, says John Halpin. He is a counselor and co-founder of a new small intensive outpatient program for substance use disorder in Charlottesville called Orchard Mountain Recovery.
A lot of people who would be listening to this, I'm sure, have some opiates that are left over in their medicine cabinet right now. But under no circumstances is that person thinking, wow, I have something that's equal to heroin in my medicine cabinet, because we don't think that way, but your body doesn't know the difference between heroin or Vicodin or oxycodone. It processes the same way.
Oxycodone is the most common drug related to overdoses from prescription opioids, according to the Virginia Department of Health.
One of the biggest problems has been that physicians not only wrote for opiates, but wrote for large quantities.
Dr. Rashid Siddiqui is a pain management physician in Charlottesville.
I tell my patients now, the amount you're taking, chances are you'll end up in the emergency room between 1 and 4 a.m. Chances are this opiate will kill you. When you're very clear about that with patients, it's not surprising how much of them are saying, well, how do we decrease our pain medicines? Since these guidelines have come out, I've done that across the board.
The guidelines he is referring to are the REMS guidelines. That stands for Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy. In 2007, the FDA gained the authority to require a REMS from manufacturers to ensure that the benefits of a drug outweigh its risks. In spite of this, the situation got worse. So in March of this year, the Virginia Board of Medicine came up with strict regulations on prescription habits.
A lot of physicians out there who are writing patients for chronic opiates have cut back, have literally stopped. The Board of Medicine is trying to say you have to wean these people off of them, not just stop it. It was one of those plans that was put into play, and they just said it was in effect, instead of giving a six-month period and assisting physicians in this. My biggest fear is these patients now are going to the streets.
That lure of illegal opioids was a big concern in the committee's report to the FDA.
Part of the challenge that we had is that if you tighten up too much on the availability of opioids, then people who need them to control their pain will suffer and are very concerned about overregulation.
Practitioners need to talk to one another to help with this transition, says Casey Landrum. She is an HIV and hepatitis C testing program coordinator at Charlottesville's Thomas Jefferson Health District.
We need to have our practitioners talking to each other about combinations of things that can happen. I have a patient, and this is their issue. What would you suggest? Or even make that referral to somebody whose specialty is whatever that person's issue is.
The committee's report recommends a combination of drug therapy with alternatives to move away from opioid treatments. Bonnie gives an overview of what works.
So there's manual therapies, physical therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness meditation, and acupuncture, too. One of the issues here is making sure that interventions of this kind known to be successful are covered by insurance.
Alternatives are getting tougher and tougher to get covered. Patients are finding the copays a lot higher for things such as physical therapy and even what I do, injection-type therapy.
It is also a problem for classic treatment centers.
One of the issues there, of course, is tied back to the healthcare debate, because one of the things that's been most helpful for providing opioid treatment has been Medicaid and the expansion of Medicaid.
In Virginia, the Republican legislature has so far refused to accept Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. But Councillor John Halpin is optimistic.
And I think the combination of education and having the right kinds of treatment available, that's what it's going to take. Recovery is possible, and it happens more often than people realize.
For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Finally, let's hear some excerpts from last week's series from Virginia Public Radio. Plans to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline through some of Virginia's scenic farmland and forests have raised serious concerns. Concerns about the environment, concerns about whether those pipelines are even needed, and concerns among an increasing number of voters who question Dominion Energy's grip on Virginia lawmakers. Sandy Hausman begins with a look at the environmental questions. Then she examines the questionable claim by Dominion that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is urgently needed. And she concludes with a look at the downside for Dominion in building these massive projects.
Fishing is good in western Augusta County. The streams run clear, perfect for brook trout. Rick Webb studied mountain streams for 30 years. Now in retirement from UVA, he's fishing and fighting to save these waterways.
Part of what I'm concerned about is maintaining what we have left. It's time to stop tearing it up. It's important for sanity, really. We need to be able to get out of the rat race and be a little closer to the natural world.
So he was alarmed when he learned the Atlantic Coast Pipeline would cut a 50-foot swath through many of Virginia's last mountain streams where brook trout survive.
We're talking about building a pipeline in extreme landscapes. Soil, which has been held in place by the trees and the undergrowth and the leaf litter on the forest floor, is suddenly exposed to the rainfall. And sometimes we get torrential rains here. And so it gets washed downhill and into the streams, and it'll choke them.
Dominion spokesman Aaron Ruby says the company can prevent that.
You know, we've fully analyzed each of the steep slopes along the route, and we've developed an approach for each of those slopes that is tailored for the unique conditions of those slopes so that they're using the most protective techniques that they can to address the unique conditions of each one of those slopes.
And he touts years of experience building pipelines through the mountains of West Virginia. But from 2012 to 2014, that state's Department of Environmental Protection cited Dominion for a ruptured pipeline that released crude oil into a stream, for then failing to contain the leak or report it. The state also says Dominion failed to respond to repeated requests for information after construction caused sedimentation in 8 streams.
When you disturb large areas of land and you turn forests into dirt, a certain amount of erosion is going to take place.
That's Evan Hansen, president of Downstream Strategies, an environmental consulting company in West Virginia. Even after a pipeline is buried and covered with grass, he says, water will run off quickly, causing erosion of stream banks. And during construction, measures that control erosion on level ground or gentle slopes may not work in the mountains. Virginia's director of environmental quality, David Paylor, is confident.
We will issue a certification that complies with the law as long as the practices can give us a reasonable assurance that water quality will be protected.
Yeah, there are those who look at the lay of the land and say it's impossible. And I'm wondering how many pipelines have actually been built through terrain similar to the route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
I'm unfortunately not the one to ask on how many pipelines.
His boss, the Secretary of Natural Resources, couldn't say either. She noted this is the first time DEQ has done a certification of this kind in a generation. Then there's the challenge of enforcement. Consultant Evan Hansen says it isn't easy.
A lot of these pipeline projects are out in the middle of nowhere, so it's not like people are driving by and noticing the impacts.
And David Sly is worried. He's a member of Wild Virginia, a group that advocates for the state's natural areas. He recalls construction of a smaller pipeline in Giles County 3 years ago. Tons of rock and mud fell into streams, and the state contacted the developer.
They said, you better fix this. But by then, a lot of the damage was done, and the delay between the time they were told to fix things and the time that it actually happened was unacceptable.
In our next report, we'll look at whether the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is really needed. The U.S. has lost much of its heavy industry. Our appliances are more energy efficient, and some customers have turned to solar or wind power. That's cut into electric company growth, according to retired utility executive Thomas Hadwin.
The utility holding companies like Dominion Energy, Duke Energy, Southern Company are finding that their utility subsidiaries are not growing in revenue. So they're seeking other sources of revenues to keep their stock price up.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will allow Dominion to earn a profit of 15% on the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, whether it's needed or not. So Hadwin says it'll be great for shareholders. That's not what Dominion is saying. Spokesman Aaron Ruby claims this is a project that will be good for its customers and essential for the economy. Solar power isn't reliable, he says, so we need gas to supply power on cloudy days and at night. And there isn't sufficient capacity in existing pipelines.
The pipeline infrastructure is stretched so thin in Hampton Roads that in recent winters, Virginia Natural Gas has had to shut off service to more than 100 major industrial customers just to be able to have enough gas to keep people's homes warm and keep hospitals running.
Hampton Roads aside, Thomas Hadwin says Dominion is mistaken when it claims there is no more room in the pipelines we already have.
That is not borne out by Department of Energy studies. It's not borne out by independent consultant studies.
And in the case of Hampton Roads, he argues, there's a much easier way to supply gas. Build connectors or smaller pipelines in existing rights-of-way to link coastal communities with existing lines.
One existing right-of-way is on the Columbia Gas System. That is the pipeline that serves Virginia Natural Gas right now. That's the one that's close to capacity. But you could put a new pipeline along that same right-of-way. So being existing right-of-way, a lot less disruption, a lot less expense. Virginia Natural Gas customers would pay a whole lot less for transportation using that pipeline than they would pay for transporting gas over the ACP.
He adds that conservation in areas now asking for more natural gas could reduce demand.
Naval Air Station Oceana near Virginia Beach, for example, just refitted over 100 buildings, and they're now saving $6 million a year on their energy costs. This could be done throughout Southeast Virginia, not just for federal installations, but for hospitals, for government buildings, for universities. And that is the largest single category of job creation in the United States. Over 2 million people are working in the energy efficiency industry right now.
That's why the Sierra Club wants the state's Corporation Commission, or SCC, to require energy-saving measures by Dominion.
Dominion is near the bottom, if not at the very bottom, of regulated utilities around the country in its energy efficiency savings.
Ivy Main is conservation chair for the Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club. She hopes the SCC will signal federal regulators that it does not intend to make ratepayers pick up the tab for an unnecessary pipeline.
The SCC does care about keeping electricity rates down. That's its mandate, and it does a pretty good job with that. The ACP is going to be bad for ratepayers. It is going to drive up electricity rates, and it's going to commit us to natural gas even when competing forms of electricity get cheaper.
Dominion claims the pipeline will actually save consumers money because the Appalachian gas it will transport is cheaper than what it now buys from the Gulf Coast. Whatever the case, many people believe there's no stopping pipelines backed by powerful corporations, politicians, labor, and business leaders. In our next report, we'll look at the political implications of Dominion's determination to build the ACP. If you watch TV in Virginia, you've probably seen some flashy commercials for Dominion Energy.
Delivering cleaner, reliable energy. Creating jobs for our veterans. Helping those in need save money on their energy bills.
Dominion spokesman Aaron Ruby says the ads are needed to inform the public.
We just changed our name, and we're moving very aggressively towards cleaner energy. And so we think it's important that our customers know what we're doing to keep their electricity reliable and affordable, and also cleaner.
Was it also an attempt to improve your public image, given that you've taken some hits lately on things like coal ash and the pipeline?
Sandy, I've answered your question.
But those who follow politics in Virginia have their doubts. Stephen Farnsworth is a professor of political science at the University of Mary Washington.
There's no question that Dominion appreciates that their privileged position in Virginia politics is less secure than it has been historically. And any company that faces the prospect of diminished influence would go to some trouble to protect its brand. And Dominion Power is doing exactly that.
In Virginia's June primary, dozens of candidates announced they would not take campaign contributions from Dominion or Appalachian Power. Among them, Democrat Tom Perriello and Republican Corey Stewart. Neither candidate won, but both had respectable showings. And Quentin Kidd, a professor of political science at Christopher Newport University, is not surprised.
I think the typical voter out there is skeptical of corporate power and skeptical of power that seems unchecked or uncheckable. And I think that's a part of where this skepticism comes from. People are skeptical of big corporations giving big amounts of money to candidates all over, whether in Virginia or whether in Washington, D.C.
Kidd says November's election is important for Dominion because next year's legislature could vote to roll back a law that took away the power of the state to examine the utility's books. If the company earned a profit above the authorized rate of 10.7%, customers could be entitled to refunds.
If, in fact, Democrats are able to pick up seats, and if among the seats they pick up, some of them are these people who wouldn't take Dominion money, and those new legislators decide to make it an issue, I could see a Republican or two come along and say, you know, look, it makes sense. Let's go ahead and roll it back. I could see it becoming bipartisan like that.
Stephen Farnsworth doesn't think that will happen because Republicans in the General Assembly have been steadfast in their support for Dominion.
The gerrymandered nature of Virginia legislative districts means that most of the incumbents, and that means mostly Republican incumbents, will be returned to Richmond.
But political organizer Josh Stanfield sees a new coalition of voters forming. He notes a strong turnout for Tom Perriello, the anti-pipeline Democrat, in Nelson County, an area that has historically supported the GOP.
There was increased Democratic activity, and therefore there is the possibility for a broader Democratic coalition in Virginia, such that Republicans would not have a shot at any statewide office ever again when compounded with demographic changes.
He's now started a grassroots group called Activate Virginia. Its main goal, getting Dominion out of politics. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and a Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.